From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we speak with the director of the documentary Growing Up Milwaukee about how she tells the stories behind the city's negative statistics. Then we examine the significance of the head nod in Black culture.
It was often a form of safety. You knew that you all had to connect. I see you. If something go down, we together. And it also was a form of respect.
We learn about Johnson Control's big move away from downtown Milwaukee and into the suburbs.
From a financial standpoint, it makes sense to consolidate at one location. And I think the obvious location is Glendale, where they have lots of underused space.
Plus, the latest Bubbler Talk explores the annexation of the village of Granville. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll examine the significance of the head nod in Black culture. We'll tell you about Johnson Control's plans to move out of downtown Milwaukee. The latest Bubbler Talk explores the annexation of the village of Granville. And we'll tell you about a new court interpreter training program in Milwaukee. But first, Milwaukee is known as one of the worst places to live as a Black person. The city has one of the largest achievement gaps between white and Black students, staggering rates of incarceration and poverty, and it's often cited as the most segregated area in the nation. Milwaukee native Tyshawn Wardlaw wanted to highlight the stories behind these statistics. Her documentary, Growing Up Milwaukee, follows three Black teens struggling as they come of age in the city. The film also features community leaders and local organizations working to improve the lives of young Black Milwaukeeans and break the cycle so many find themselves in. The film debuted on HBO Max this month, and Wardlaw joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more. Wardlaw begins by explaining how the project came to be.
The premise of the doc was actually created 4 years ago when I decided that, you know what, unfortunately, a lot of staggering statistics are coming out of Milwaukee in the Black community, from Milwaukee being the Black place for Blacks to actually live at in the United States as a city, for the incarceration rate, for economic disparities, just all of these things that were happening in the Black community. And so I set out to be able to tell the stories behind those statistics. But I also wanted to do it from the youth perspective, because I know that the youth are our future, you know, depending on, you know, it doesn't matter what city they're in, you know, eventually they're going to grow up to be tomorrow's leaders and, you know, potentially also guide the way for what's happening in their community. So with that being said, I set out 4 years ago to actually be able to tell these stories. So back then we didn't have funding yet or anything. It was just the ideal. I was just actually starting my television production company here locally in Milwaukee at the time as well, just getting my name out there. And I was actually able to put, and I hate to say casting call, but for lack of a better word, because I know it's not a narrative or a feature film, but I did allow just to go to nonprofits, but youth-based organizations to say, hey, do you have any youth where we're doing this documentary that you think would be great for us to talk to, that would love to kind of, you know, share their truths and their stories about what it means for them to grow up in the city? And at the time, like I said, it was just concept 4 years ago. But 2 years ago, actually going on three now that we're in 2021, I was able to get our first round of funding to actually start filming. And at that moment, when I got the funds, it was like everything started to come together, kind of what I mentioned, that it was just so purposeful, where when I was actually speaking to a few youth organizations, they happened to have individuals that I felt with Brandon, Marquell, and Tiana that would fit in what I thought would be relevant to, you know, going behind some of the statistics. So prime example, Tiana was a teen mom. Like, she was literally aging out of the group home system. She had a child at the age of 14. And then also Brandon was just literally getting out of, you know, being incarcerated as a teen and being put into a group home. And then Marquell was just dealing with all that he was dealing with internally at home, as well as having mentors actually in his life even before we met. So I felt that that would be a great fit. And then they were all willing, you know, to be able to share their truths with us at that time. So it just happened exactly how it needed to happen. And I was just so grateful that they allowed me to be able to film with them for 2 years.
Yeah, and 2 years is a long time, and it's not uncommon for documentaries, you know, to have that kind of relationship. But how did you build trust with them and also within the shared spaces they take you? Because there's a lot of great group scenes, whether it's at Vincent High School or other organizations, where there's a lot of other kids sharing their stories too and being as vulnerable.
Yeah, and I think, once again, I was very fortunate. And sometimes we even had our own issues with the youth where they were like, you know what, I just don't want to film today. And I'm like, but we're coming. Like, you know, we have to film. And they're like, no, we don't. Not today. So, you know, we did have our moments where, you know, they just like, I just don't want to share today. So I had to be respectful. And I think that's how the relationship worked, that, you know, when it was time to film, they were more than willing, you know, to let us in, even if it was painful, because we had some painful moments where there was probably some things they didn't want to share. You know, I'm embarrassed I got kicked out of school. You know, we kind of had to pry teeth a little bit to even be able to get the full story out. But, you know, he shared that truth, you know, and you could tell that he was, you know, kind of remorseful, like, man, you know, I messed up, or I didn't want to let anybody down. But it's about your growth. And it's about, you know, you going through the process because it's your life. So I'm really thankful for them even being able to allow us in. And then even when we were in those moments with some of the teens where, you know, they weren't the featured youth in the film, but, you know, they were in a safe place in those moments that those schools provided, that they were even though the camera was there, they still did not hold back their truth.
Mm-hmm. And are you yourself a Milwaukee native?
So I am. So I am a Milwaukee native where I grew up in Milwaukee. I am a self-proclaimed floater, for a lack of a better word, because I did leave Milwaukee. I left Milwaukee right out of high school to attend college at Santa Clara University in California. So I was gone for 4 years, moved back with anticipation on working in Chicago, and then kind of went into the news industry here, and then left and moved back out to California to work in the talk show world, and then moved back to Chicago to work in the talk show world and also do some producing work in the industry there. And then that's when about 5 years ago, I decided, you know what, I want to tell stories about what's happening right here in my hometown. And so I became a little bit more stationary, but we do have an office that's also opening in Chicago this spring. So we're excited to kind of create our footprint there as well and be a Midwest-based production company between both cities. But, you know, Milwaukee is always home. I might end up on the moon eventually, but, you know, Milwaukee's home, and I really care about what's happening in the city that I was born and raised in.
Filmmaking is such a powerful tool to share with people what is going on, connecting and creating empathy, because so many people in Milwaukee, their growing up Milwaukee is not what's being shown in your film. And with filmmaking, and especially getting picked up by HBO Max, and congratulations on that, by the way, what kind of work did you do to distribute this film? Because it is such a powerful connector. And ultimately, as a filmmaker, that is the goal, to get as many people as you can to see it.
Yeah, and I think, and I've been very fortunate. And when I decided that I wanted to tell the story about what was happening in Milwaukee, I thought nationally. I had no doubt in my mind that what I wanted to tell, I didn't know exactly how it was going to turn out, who was going to be in it, but I knew that it was important to get what was happening in our city on a national level and get behind those stories and to make an impact on a national and international level. So I feel like everything just really came into place, where sometimes it's like, it kind of sounds generic and like a Hollywood ending story, but I have no other way but to put it that it just all continued to unfold in all of the power that it needed to. Over time, as we were filming, the people we met with, like, everybody was where they needed to be, including the distribution of it. Because prime example, we did literally start wrapping the film at the end of like 2019 going into 20. And I knew, of course, you know, that I wanted to get that film out in 2020. Like everyone else, we didn't know that the world was going to literally shut down and change as we know it going into 2020. So I believe that I was kind of setting myself up with having a really good rough edit and then being able to aggressively actually get the film out as a director and producer to different networks. I was just aggressively reaching out to networks You know, letting them know that the film was done, providing them with screeners. So I did actually have the opportunity to have a few different networks actually have interest and offers. And I felt that HBO Max at the time would be a great fit. I think I made the right choice. I feel comfortable with what I did.
In Growing Up Milwaukee, you feature local leaders and also people just being mentors or also just fighting to make Black lives in Milwaukee better. And what struck me the most is that so much of their work is making sure young people simply know their worth, their talents, their potential. You know, it's their sense of hopelessness is kind of really resounding in the film, and the kids are just fighting to not get completely dragged down. So with the title Growing Up Milwaukee, what does it mean to you as the director, and what do you hope it means for the audience after they see this? Because Growing Up Milwaukee, after watching it, you know, it shows a lot of struggle, but also a lot of resilience.
I think it was my initial ideal as well, and especially in the editing process, was to come to an audience where they could say, you know what, all hope isn't lost, because as you said, like, there are certain levels of trauma that people weren't, you know, aware that some of the youth are facing, or they actually might have faced that, you know, a portion of that or a little piece of that in their own lives. So it resonated with them, even on a personal level. But yet I want people to walk away that all hope isn't lost. Milwaukee is a lot of things as far as statistics, but we're not hopeless. So I was hoping that people would walk away with that sense, and also that it would potentially be a call of action for people to even say, like, hey, what could I do, or how can I get involved? Whether that was on a resource level, you know, with reaching out to different youth organizations, or even, you know, starting up a youth and grassroots organization on your own. But however that would inspire you to actually want to continue to implement change. But I think that it all should resonate with people that we're all going to go through something, but yet, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel, or there's people, as we saw that was in the film, that are out there that are helping create a new narrative and change the narrative that people are currently being, you know, shown about the cities.
Yeah, as you said, there's a lot of indications of the community healers, leaders, but a lot of other people here in Milwaukee have to step up too, and that's everyone from your neighbor to city officials. And one thing that was said in your film by a local expert is that Milwaukee is not willing to look at the realities of our city. And as a native, I agree with that. And you mentioned changing the narrative. So how do we go from the smaller scale to getting city leaders and state leaders and getting changes to policy funding to address the inequities impacting people's lives that keeps them trapped in this narrative, in this cycle?
Sometimes it's not just kind of throwing money at the problems, because once again, the problems won't go. But don't get me wrong, funding and resources definitely count, and they give opportunities for things to grow, but actually coming up with solutions to the problem, and not to saying that we're not doing that. But I think, you know, even in legislation, like, continuously, we know these problems exist, but how can we be a solution to it? Whether that's funding, whether that's, you know, creating manpower, whether that's creating just different levels of support that would help continue to make things better. And I think we all have to have our hands in it. And it starts from the top. And then step by step, things aren't going to change overnight. Just because, you know, I created a film that kind of highlights some of these things. And, you know, fortunately, it's being able to be seen on a national platform doesn't mean that people are going to pick up and, you know, start running and changing things. But I do hope that, you know, there is a sense of urgency to continue working on things that people have already been doing and or starting to implement a new plan and new solutions to some of these same existing problems that we've had for many years.
Well, Growing Up Milwaukee is certainly a powerful film, now available on HBO Max for everyone to see. Tyshawn, I want to thank you so much for not only making it, but of course, taking the time to speak with me about it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tyshawn Wardlaw is the director and producer of the documentary Growing Up Milwaukee, which debuted this month on HBO Max. The film can also be rented on Milwaukee Film's digital platform until the 28th as part of their Black History Month program. Wardlaw spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
I'm WUWM's LaToya Dennis. We all know that, culturally, there are different ways of communicating. When it comes to Black people, we've relied upon a head nod. To some, it may look like a simple gesture, but for Black men especially, it can be a way of saying, I see you and all is well. I recently sat down with a group of Black men between the ages of 28 and 75 to talk about the importance of the head nod. Anthony Courtney founded an organization called For My Brothers Incorporated. He describes it as a manhood training program. Courtney is also the eldest and is respectfully called Baba by the other men. Baba is an African term denoting respect due to one's age and status in society. Courtney says the head nod dates back to slavery.
When Black people were planning rebellions, the men on the plantations, okay, what would take place, they wouldn't talk. When it was going to go down, they simply, you know, wanted to clarify when it was going to go down, so they went on about their business till they got ready to take care of business.
When Courtney takes pause, he's doing a head nod. He says that over the years, the meaning of the head nod has evolved.
What it is an acknowledgement of a brother, wherever you went in the country during our time, you may not have known these other brothers, or you've been in a situation where there were very few Black men, and you might have been in meetings or whatever, a lot of white folks or whatever.
Courtney says you would simply nod your head at each other.
That was it. And that was an acknowledgement of that this was a brother, even though you may not have talked to him. In most cases, 99% of the cases, you got the head nod back. And if you didn't get the head nod back, then you watch this brother.
Andre Ellis is 60 years old. He's the founder of We Got This, a grassroots program aimed at teaching young Black men to grow food and clean up their neighborhoods.
It was often a form of safety. You knew that you all had to connect. I see you. If something go down, we together. And it also was a form of respect with each other, because even when you were at events where, what I remember in the 60s and 70s, especially being a young boy, 67, 68, when the riots came, what I remember is I couldn't wait to grow up and be big enough to do the head nod. It was a form of cool as well, especially if your hat was tipped to the right in that deep dip.
Travis Hardman is the youngest of the group and a small business owner.
Normally, most people, you know, nod their head up with a, you know, in a what's up manner. It's totally safety, because most men are, you know, our primal instincts is to, you know, wired to fight. So what it does, it lets the next brother know, hey, everything's cool. We can walk past each other and we can go about our day. And when you do run into the people who, when you nod your head and they don't nod back, it kind of does give you a feeling of not being safe, or something may just occur.
Kwabena Anton Nixon rounds out the group of men. He's 51 years old and an author and a representative of the I Will Not Die Young campaign. The Chicago native says growing up, the head nod wasn't something he did.
You know, being in Chicago, and Bob, I can attest to this, you know, you didn't speak to nobody you didn't know from another neighborhood, because you don't know what the move is, because the head nod sometimes where we came from was like, there we go right there. You know, that's him over there. And you see your guy like, this is what it is, right? So when I moved to Milwaukee, it was crazy when I moved here and so many people were speaking, I would like, you know, because I don't know what it is. And I remember a dude I moved on 13th and Atkinson, his brother, older brother, was like, young man, he said, what's up? He said, man, we speak to you daily. You don't speak to nobody. I said, what you mean? He's like, I'm nodding, letting you know. I was like, I didn't know that, right? It took me a minute to understand what it was, because in Chicago, where I was coming from, it meant here they come. But when it's me and my age, 50 and older, and we do it, and I get in one and they don't, I take that like, what's up with you? You understand? Because as Travis said, it's connect. You know, we even say as far as Peace King, you know, that's been a universal thing no matter where I've been. Brothers see each other, you go, Peace, especially now. And I heard a lot of young dudes doing it too. So I think everybody said it is a universal nod of like, peace.
You know, LaToya, if I can add in here real quick too, the nod got me robbed in New York in 1990. I was in New York and a couple of friends were visiting me and we were walking down the street and a guy was coming towards us and I nodded at him and I did the traditional sup. We didn't say what's up, we said sup, S-U-P, sup. And I did sup and he said, you know who I am? And people were walking on the street and everything. And I said, no, I was just speaking. He said, well, let me teach you something about New York. We don't do that here, break yourself. And he took all my jewelry and the money that I had on me. And so I had to immediately, like Quabbin, I said, with Chicago, I had to come and adjust. I had to immediately adjust to New York that you don't speak walking down the street, that you almost look at the ground just like you don't look up at the buildings because then the robber can recognize that you're a tourist.
Oh, you're not from here. Right. You ain't from here.
The other thing is that when Quabbin talked about everybody in Milwaukee speaking, that was a Southern thing. And I bet you Baba can attest to that. Everybody that came from down south was already used to being congenial with each other. And you spoke to each other. If you go down south today, they say speak and say hello and how you doing on the street. Even white folks that are friendly with others do it as well.
So how do you know when to do it and when not to?
It's also this, you say, when do you know? Sometimes for me, I can't speak. And I think Trev said this earlier. It's disarming too. You can disarm if they're in situation to look a certain way, even when I'm working with youngins. Oh, it don't matter. If I walk up on the block, it's a peace. You know, that's the nod, right? You understand? It's a discern, you know, it's almost you disarm them just for that moment. When I say disarm, it makes everything comfortable amongst this room. Like, hey, this is what we own today, right? I think it's instinctual. I don't think it's I better do the head nod. It's just, oh, there goes so-and-so, what's up? Especially when I work with young men, I go out of my way to show them, like, we did a group of young boys, probably about 15, when I brought all the men to school. By the time we all got left the room, I kept saying, everybody make sure you keep saying peace, king, peace, king. We left the room when I came back the following week. That's how they was acknowledging them. What's up, King? You know, they was doing their own little thing with it, but they were all peace, King. You know, I said, oh, okay, peace, King. For that moment, 3 weeks while we were at that school, that was their acknowledgement. They talked to each other in that fashion. You know what I mean? So we introduced it to her early. So as Trev said, it's universal.
Oftentimes we don't share with the younger people what Baba is trying to do with old school. We ain't through yet. We don't attend those events. Do we take our sons and nephews and boys from the block? We should be flooding out every event that he have like that. Quabbin and I was doing the barbershop talks. And I think that we need to make sure we do all of those things still. We shouldn't do them just fashionably. We need to do them universally. And I think we need to get back to having the conversation of how do we grieve? Why not? Because it may decrease some of the negativity we're dealing with.
Right. I mean, at one point, Quabbin said that when he moved here, he didn't know what that was, right? Because the head nod meant something different where he was from. So who teaches it?
Black boys have to be socialized, the rites of passage, a number of things, right? As Trev said, it's instinctual, right? But now these are ways and I'm using the term socializing for safety and for culture, right? With my grandkids, with my young men I work with, my little cousins, I even went as far to say, give them the nod. You know, what you mean give them the nod, right? They pattern what they see. So who teaches it? It's a part of the culture as young as you can get it. When you have a black boy, young black male in the house, that's a part of his upbringing, how he acts at the barbershop, how he deals with others right now. That's a lost art. You understand what I mean? It's not as many doing it. So how do you teach it? Boys see, be what they see. They see us act, we act. You have to teach it in the very beginning, as early as possible, how we do it. And I would say this, what Andre said, I think everything is marketing. It has to become fashionable. Death is fashionable in our community. Murder is fashionable. Dying young is fashionable. Why I'll say that? Because they get more love sometimes in death than they do in their everyday life. They get more props on social media for doing something ignorant than they do some positive. So as we have to make it fashionable. So we're making living fashionable now. We're making living long fashionable. We're making poetry fashionable. We're making having conversations and peace fashionable. So I think that's who teaches it. You know what I mean? It's culturally shown from the day a black boy is born. What he watches a man do is how he'll act.
Coming up, court interpreters are supposed to help people understand what's happening in a courtroom. But sometimes those interpreters may not have the training they need to help someone fully understand what a judge or lawyer is saying. In about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about a new training program that's trying to change that in Milwaukee. But first, we'll look at Johnson Control's decision to move to Glendale from downtown Milwaukee after more than a century in the city. That's coming up on Lake Effect here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Johnson Controls has been a part of Milwaukee for almost as long as the city has existed. It remains one of the largest companies in the area, despite the fact the company moved its headquarters overseas. But that's all about to change. The company announced it will be closing its Milwaukee campus and moving all operations to another campus in Glendale. Tom Dakin has been covering the story for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins me now to talk about it. Tom, thank you so much for joining us once again here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Troy.
Johnson Controls has had this really interesting ongoing saga here in Wisconsin. It seems like it's been this continual churn of moving jobs away from Milwaukee and to other places, perhaps most notably when the company changed its headquarters to Cork, Ireland. So I'd like to take a step back and really look at the big picture. Historically, what has Johnson Controls meant to the city of Milwaukee?
Well, Johnson Controls has been one of the signature companies really for the state of Wisconsin and for the Milwaukee area. It has longstanding roots here going back to the late 19th century. The Controls name comes from the invention of what is the thermostat and controlling temperatures within buildings. And from that, Johnson Controls evolved into a very large global business that manufactured controls for heating, air conditioning, ventilation, and then later things like security systems and other systems for both homes, but mostly for larger commercial buildings, offices, hospitals, hotels, those sorts of things. And I believe it was in the 90s when Johnson Controls took a bigger step into the business of supplying components for the automotive industry. Johnson Controls already had developed a battery division that was creating car batteries, but then it also started creating car interiors, seats essentially, that it would then sell to General Motors, Ford, all the big auto manufacturers. That business became less profitable. Margins became thinner as competition intensified, particularly with both domestic and foreign automakers. And the company really started changing roughly about 5 or 6 years ago.
That's around the time Johnson Controls moved to Cork, Ireland. Of course, they're no longer a Fortune 500 company because their headquarters are outside of the U.S. A variety of things changed at that time. What did that mean for Wisconsin? What was the impact on Wisconsin and Milwaukee more specifically?
It's really interesting to consider that as late as 2015, Johnson Controls was considering the development of a new downtown office tower on Milwaukee's lakefront, essentially at Clybourne and Lincoln Memorial Drive. And the company then had around 3,000 Milwaukee area employees. A year later, in 2016, Johnson Controls merged with Tyco International. And that's when the merged company located its headquarters in Ireland to reduce its tax bill, of course. And it was later that year in 2016 that Johnson Controls then spun off that automotive seating business we talked about earlier. That company is now known as Adient. And any jobs connected to that were here locally no longer exist. You then also had, a few years later, Johnson Controls getting out of the automotive battery business. However, it's interesting, when they spun that business off, it ended up keeping a large presence here in the Milwaukee area, specifically at the Glendale campus, where that business, which is now known as Clarios, leases close to 300,000 square feet at the Glendale campus from Johnson Controls. So we do still have a lot of jobs there, but they're not Johnson Control jobs. They're Clarios jobs, for whatever that's worth.
Well, and of course, Johnson Controls is moving from downtown to Glendale. As they do that, what is that going to mean for the company?
Well, for the company, I think it's an attempt to reduce their costs, quite simply. We mentioned earlier that Johnson Controls, back in 2015, when they were contemplating this downtown office tower, had around 3,000 Milwaukee area employees. That's now down to around 2,000 Milwaukee area employees. And it's split between 1,300 at that downtown office complex, which is roughly one block on the east side of downtown, and really only about 700 or so employees at the Glendale campus, where Johnson Controls has buildings that total over 450,000 square feet on 33 acres. In other words, they have these buildings in Glendale that are really underused. And it really, from a financial standpoint, it makes sense to consolidate at one location. And I think the obvious location is Glendale, where they have lots of underused space. I think they also see a chance to showcase the Glendale campus as a place for their products and services, their various building control products and services. So you have that advantage of showcasing their operations there.
As you say, it seems like there's a lot of benefits for Johnson Controls, but of course, people in Milwaukee are going to be looking at this in the context of, this is a company that's taking jobs from the center of Milwaukee and moving them into the suburbs. What could that move away from downtown mean for the city?
Almost immediately, it's going to mean, within a few years, we're going to have seven buildings totaling more than 420,000 square feet that are going to be available for new uses. Now, Johnson Controls has said that once they sell these buildings, and we don't know who the buyer is yet, they've just started the process of marketing them. But once they sell these buildings, Johnson Controls will lease them back for up to 2 years as it moves its operations from downtown to Glendale. So it's not like they're going to leave immediately, but eventually those buildings are going to be available for new uses. And I suspect office is not the highest and best use for those properties anymore. We have a lot of surplus office space right now in downtown Milwaukee. And with the pandemic and employers realizing that they may not necessarily need as much office space as they previously expected to have because of the ability of people to work remotely, you're going to have probably more surplus office space on the market. So I would not be surprised if at least a portion of those buildings are converted to residential uses. We still seem to have strong demand for housing apartments, particularly higher end apartments throughout the downtown area. And that, I think, would be a logical outcome of those building sales.
What is the marketability of pretty massive buildings downtown? Because it seems like a lot of developers, either they're taking really historic spaces like the Plankinton Mall and redesigning those, and you know they're buying them for the history and the architecture. But with a building like these, would they really be converting them, or is this a kind of teardown project?
It's a mix, I think, of both. If you can envision that block of buildings, the eastern end of the block, you have a really what I think is, it's all in the eye of the beholder, right? But a pretty attractive mid-rise historic building. I think it's about six or seven stories. And it dates back, I believe, to the 1890s. And I think that's the kind of building that often lends itself really well to what you were just describing, these historic preservation conversion projects. Next to it, you have a newer building, the Johnson Controls, I think they call it the Brengle Technology Center. That opened about 20 years ago. That's a newer office building, but it really, by today's standards, is probably already obsolete to some extent. And that also could be a very strong conversion candidate. And then you have some lower rise buildings on the western end of the block of maybe three, four stories. And those are buildings that I could speculate in here, but I could usually see those being demolished and not having as greater value as those two other buildings.
I guess time will tell.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect once again and sharing your work.
I always enjoy being here. Thanks, Joy.
Tom Dakin covers commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's a regular Lake Effect contributor. You can find our previous conversations about development in Milwaukee at WUWM.com, including a look at how the city's hotels and event spaces are handling this pandemic.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
In the 19th century, Wisconsin's territorial legislature divided Milwaukee County into seven townships. Five of them eventually became municipalities: Milwaukee, Wauwatosa, Greenfield, Franklin, and Oak Creek. But two of those original townships were absorbed by the city of Milwaukee and live on now as neighborhood names: Lake and Granville. I'm WUWM's Emily Files. Last year, I explored the history of Lake. Now we'll travel to the northwest corner of Milwaukee County for Chapter 2, Granville. Terry Warner sent us the question that prompted this story. He grew up in Elm Grove in the 1950s and 60s and remembers as a child making the drive east to his grandmother in Bayside.
The way you survived a road trip was you looked out the window and looked at things.
Terry remembers driving through the village of Granville on a regular basis.
And once you were north of Appleton Avenue, you were in the country. You were really in the country. And it was all working dairy farms until you got to that little Granville station.
Terry has wondered why Granville never became its own suburb. To answer that question, I turned to local history buff Ron Winkler.
Granville was the township that was in the extreme northwest corner of Milwaukee County.
Winkler says Granville was a farming mecca into the mid-1900s. That played into why it didn't become its own city.
Granville was highly agricultural. As a result of that, Granville never attained the population that was necessary to incorporate.
Winkler says, following World War II, Milwaukee and the surrounding communities were in a race to expand their borders and snatch up remaining townland.
And that's why we ended up with a lot of new suburbs during that time period.
There were a number of annexation wars, including a battle between Milwaukee and Brown Deer over Granville. Brown Deer was a former section of Granville that incorporated and then sought to absorb the rest of the township.
But then the city of Milwaukee challenged the incorporation.
The battle lasted 6 years and went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. In 1962, Milwaukee won over what Winkler says were some minor errors on Brown Deer's petition to incorporate.
And that actually was the largest annexation that the city of Milwaukee ever had at one time.
Winkler says Granville in the present day reflects its agricultural roots. It's one of the most rural parts of the city, dotted with parks, including Havenwood State Forest.
It still is one of my favorite places to go biking because I do feel like I'm out in the country.
Shantia Lewis represents the 9th District, which encompasses much of former Granville Township, on the Milwaukee Common Council. She says residents treasure the rural atmosphere of the far northwest side.
They want to continue to you know, be a rural town in a urban city. It's an amenity to everyone.
Lewis is pushing for revitalization of Northwest Milwaukee. The vacant Northridge Mall is an example of the economic decline the area has experienced. But Lewis says new businesses are settling in Granville.
We are affectionately calling it the new 9th. So it's the rebranding, it's the hope, and it's the way that we're envisioning what a new northwest side of town could look like.
Lewis says Granville's agricultural history and the annexation war over it should be a source of pride as residents look to the future of the far northwest side.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Sun Badger Solar. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Coming up, court interpreters are supposed to help people understand their legal rights and ramifications. But what if that interpreter isn't properly trained?
if a person is not able to understand what's happening to their lives, an interpreter is allowing that person to really pursue justice. If they're not able to understand, a person's constitutional rights could be violated.
We'll tell you about a new court interpreter training program here in Milwaukee next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Going to court, whether it's as a criminal defendant or just to fight a parking ticket, is a stressful experience. But imagine if you had to do it and you couldn't understand what the judge or your attorneys were saying. That can often be the case for people who aren't proficient in English or are hearing impaired in Wisconsin courtrooms. Deborah Gorbarash is a court-certified American Sign Language interpreter who noticed a need for more interpreters and better training. Now she instructs a program at UW-Milwaukee's School of Continuing Education to help fix this problem. Barash spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver about the Legal Interpreter Training Program.
One of the motivators for me to personally develop this training program was because for many years I just see this, what I call a hidden injustice. And that is for people who are in our legal system, if English is not their first language and an interpreter is required for communication. And notice I didn't say that the interpreter is for the person who doesn't speak English, because the interpreter is for everyone in an environment. Because a judge or an attorney can understand the person who doesn't speak English just as much as the person who doesn't speak English understand those who do. And if a person is not able to understand what's happening to their lives, an interpreter is allowing that person and everyone else in the environment to really pursue justice. If they're not able to understand, a person's constitutional rights could be violated, which is what motivated me to create this program, because we have so many interpreters who have not been trained and are not qualified but are interpreting, and it's not their fault. And it's not the fault of the judicial system, although the judicial system continues to hire interpreters who are not qualified because they basically don't have a choice. The National Center for State Courts offers legal certification in 18 different languages, which sounds like a lot. But even here in Wisconsin, we use in our Wisconsin court system somewhere between 55 and 60 different languages every year in our court system. So that leaves a significant number of languages that have no certification, and that includes sign language interpreters now, because we used to have a legal certification and that is no more. And so for all the languages that do not have a certification, a person can be hired, walk into court and start interpreting, and no one has any idea whether that person actually can interpret at the level that's needed to preserve a person's constitutional right and be able to accurately interpret at the level we need for justice to be served.
How does this program, in a nutshell, then try to train people to be certified legal court interpreters?
Well, for many years, and I believe over the past, I would say 5 years or more, I have increasingly had experiences where I'm brought into a court case as a sign language interpreter, and there is also a spoken language interpreter interpreting in the same case. No one across the country has a program to teach how sign language and spoken language interpreters can work together effectively. And as I continued to have these experiences, I said, somebody has to do something about this. And so this program, in its uniqueness, is that we're training sign language and spoken language interpreters together. They are learning the similarities and differences and how to then walk into a case and say, what do we need to make sure that we're working together and this is an effective, accurate service that we're providing for all of the people in this situation. So that's a big difference in this training program than any other training program that we were able, we did a lot of research trying to find out, is there anywhere that people train sign language and spoken language interpreters together? And there isn't as far as we've been able to find. So that's an incredible uniqueness about this program. And also the focused content about the program. We teach about culture and how that influences the interpretation, because we know in every community, in every country, there are deaf individuals. So how do we combine all of the cultural aspects in addition to the deafness or hard of hearing aspects when we're dealing with a case in court? We have legal vocabulary throughout the entire program, which is a 12-month program with 7 courses that are developed. We also are going to be doing mock hearings and at the end culminating into a mock trial. So we'll be looking at every aspect of the legal realm. We're ensuring that all the interpreters are well trained just individually to know about the legal system. And in addition to that, how do you work with sign language interpreters as well? How do they work with each other? Yes, spoken language and sign language interpreters working together.
And how do you know if someone who signs up for the course is actually proficient or fluent in the language that they're professing to be?
We do have prerequisites to be able to get into the program. And so we do look at their language and ask them to provide some verification about their language abilities and their interpreting knowledge before they even get into the course. Our Wisconsin court system, the court interpreter program, does offer a 2-day orientation program. And we require that individuals for this program at UWM have already taken that program, which gives them a very basic idea. One of the things we've heard out of that 2-day orientation program that has been in existence over the past 18 years is that most often the comment on the evaluation is, we need more training. And it just isn't out there. And so, again, that was another motivator for me, since I've been involved in that over all these years, was to say, we have to do something. We have to be able to provide some kind of credential to say to our Wisconsin court system, this person has a minimum standard of knowledge because they've been through the Wisconsin UWM training program for legal interpreters. Right now, we have nothing.
Has anyone graduated from this program yet, or is this the first?
This is the very first cohort. We started August 28th, and so we are into our third course right now, and it'll go. People will complete the program in August.
What sort of adaptions have you been able to make with COVID, and who's in the program right now?
I did not want to have to do this online, but we did because I wanted to make sure that we really were able to get this program up and established, even in the midst of COVID. So I converted it completely to online. So I'm teaching it all online. Everyone's online. And as we all are saying through this pandemic, there are positives and negatives to everything. One of the very positive things is we have someone in Arizona, and we have someone who is in Costa Rica. Her home is the Green Bay, But she's in Costa Rica caring for some elderly parents. And because of that, she's able to be in the program. So that's really wonderful. We're very happy about that. We began the program with 19 participants. We were going to accept up to 20. A few of them had to drop out. We are now at 14 participants. We have American Sign Language interpreters, Spanish interpreters, Arabic, French, Hindi, Portuguese, and Hmong.
And what does life post-certificate look for these people once they've graduated from the program? Are they looking to work in the Milwaukee County Circuit Court system or around the state? And what does being a court interpreter part-time look like or full-time?
Many sign language interpreters are able to work full-time as interpreters, and the more popular languages are able to work more full-time. But that's one of the challenges of this program, because most of the people in this program come from minority communities to begin with. Their first language is not English, so they come from those communities, and it's not lucrative where they're going to be able to work necessarily full-time as a court interpreter. Hopefully, they can develop their skills and work in other aspects, such as the medical field or even in a work environment and so forth. So having the interpreting skills under your belt and credentials is certainly helpful.
Deborah Gora-Barash, thank you very much for your time and good luck with the program.
Thank you. Yeah, we look forward to it. Watch for more.
Deborah Gora-Barash is an instructor for the Legal Interpreter Training Program at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about George Marshall Clark, the only known black man lynched in Milwaukee. He was buried in an unmarked grave at Forest Home Cemetery. Now, there's an effort to change that. We'll hear from the man behind that effort tomorrow. We'll also take a look at Governor Tony Evers' proposed budget and what kind of funding he plans to put into education. That's all tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.